It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and we're going to talk about some of the prairie's most charismatic predators, wolves, coyotes, and foxes today. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. I've just returned. My wife and I just got back late last night from a four-day trip farther north. We went up into Minnesota on the Minnesota Avian Adventure with the two naturalists, Matt Wietrich from Carroll County and Megan Cook from Sac County, and in search of some of the northern birds and mammals, but especially the birds. Of course, it's an avian adventure. We did see great gray owls, and we've talked lots about owls on this program before. And we found three different great grays, so we were very, very fortunate. We saw spruce grouse and ruff grouse and black-backed woodpeckers, had a great view of that. So, and about 40 other species as well. So it was quite an adventure, and warm for a Minnesota winter, that's for sure. It wasn't 30 to 40 below zero by any means, but it was colder than it is here, that's for sure.
And maybe not quite as wet there?
That's right. Definitely not as wet. They had, I would say, about a foot of snow or so. It wasn't a great amount of snow, but it was plenty.
Well, we're happy to have you back, and you didn't happen to see or hear any wolves when you were up north, did you?
No, we did not. I did see tracks along the road at one point that very well were either a very, very large dog or were a single wolf track, and we did spot, however, several coyotes along the way. So these Midwestern canids are certainly around, no question about it. I saw fox tracks as well. So.
Nice. All right, well, let's talk about wolves a little bit, because, of course, we don't typically have wolves in Iowa. We've had a couple make their way into the state in recent years, but we used to have wolves.
Yeah, wolves were certainly present in Iowa before Euro-Americans came in here. And they were, there's all sorts of new data that's coming in from DNA stuff. But there were thought to be two sort of subspecies of the gray wolf. Whether they were true subspecies or not is up for question. But anyway, certainly there was the timber wolf, and then there was the prairie wolf. And there were some morphological, some physical differences in them, but there weren't. You know, they were basically the same species. Would they interbreed? Absolutely. But there were wolves here in Iowa. And what happened, of course, along with lots and lots of other wildlife species as Euro-American settlers came in, is that they were exploited and seen primarily as competitors for the same species. So Euro-American settlers, pioneering is a hard business, and building railroads is tough. You couldn't just go down to the store and grab a package of meat. So you depended upon market hunters, Buffalo Bill and other folks like him, that hunted game in very, very large quantities. They shot whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, and as many as they wanted, to supply meat for these settlers. And that was the primary way of getting by. So wolves were eating the same things, so they wiped out the wolves pretty quickly. I think the last one was about 1885 or so, and that was up in Butler County. It was sort of wiped the last of the wolves out, but the populations had been severely reduced by the 1860s.
Well, and not only were the wolves competition for the things that the settlers wanted to eat, but they were also just feared and reviled.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. All of the European culture of all the stories about wolves and came with our European ancestors as they came over. And so that was absolutely definitely reviled, seen as vermin, et cetera, et cetera. So they wiped them out. And what happened is really interesting, because the coyote then, that was mostly a Western species, a Great Plains species and farther west, gradually moved eastward. In fact, as the wolf was wiped out in the eastern half of the country, as well as the western half, but especially the eastern half, the coyotes moved east. And, of course, we now have coyotes coast to coast as a result.
And the wolves, leaving this vacancy as they were right. exterminated, coyotes moved in, but they're different predators. So, I mean, obviously yeah. this was an opportunity, but why was it an opportunity? Because they weren't necessarily hunting the same game.
No, not at all. In fact, but they were seen as sort of sworn enemies. You look at the evidence of this in Yellowstone today, where wolves were reintroduced and have been very, very successful at redistributing the elk population in particular, and coyotes have been there for a long time. But did they coexist with wolves? Well, to some extent, I would say on the edges. And what's happened in Yellowstone, for example, is that the coyotes, they may hang around to try and get some of the leftovers when a wolf pack is finished eating. But if they're caught, they will be killed by the wolves. And so the two do not coexist very well. Very rarely will they wolves allow coyotes to be in the same area. They hunt very differently. They're talking different sizes of prey. All canids are opportunistic predators. So will a coyote eat a carcass killed by a wolf or by a car or anything else? Absolutely. Will a fox feed on a carcass killed by a coyote? Absolutely. They're opportunistic predators, but they really fundamentally feed on different sizes of prey and hunt in a different way. Wolves were primarily pack hunters because they're larger. Weighing probably up to twice as much as or more than coyotes. Big males are much, much larger than a coyote. So they're hunting different sizes of prey. They're hunting different prey, and they're hunting in packs versus hunting more solitarily as coyotes do. So it's really fundamentally different different hunting strategies and different prey.
So in many ways, the wolves being gone, that opened up an opportunity for coyotes because the wolves made life hard for coyotes.
Exactly. All right. Exactly. Yes.
Well, and now, of course, we have many coyotes in urban areas, in rural areas, all over the state of Iowa. I'm going to play a little bit of sound. This is one of my favorite sounds to hear when I'm out at night, but it's a pretty common sound in Iowa.
You bet.
And that's a pack of coyotes.
It's great, isn't it?
Making a lot of noise. And, of course, if you're out at night, you could very easily think, oh, there's the neighbor's dog going
right.
crazy.
Well,
And the dogs will go crazy when
right,
they hear that.
Right, right. Often joining in. It's quite interesting because coyotes are really what you described as a pack is really a family group as much as anything, because they tend to, as I said earlier, they tend to hunt solitarily as opposed to wolves that hunt in packs. And coyotes, these family groups, these yelps and yips and howls are very, very different than that sort of deep-throated howl of the wolf. But the communication, the reason for the communication, the vocalizations are the same. It's communicating between individuals in the group, as well as between different groups of coyotes. They're telling other coyotes, "Yep, we're here. Better stay out of our territory." And they're telling individuals in the group, boy, am I glad to see you. It's really nice to be a part of this this family. You know, it's really an interesting sort of communication strategy. But that was that particular one had some pups in it. It was probably a greeting call as adult came back from a hunt. And talking to one another, expressing their joy.
Well, let's talk about the social structure, since it's different from wolves, but they do have these family groups that are very close.
Right.
So how does that work?
Well, it works well. it is somewhat different than other canids, although not entirely. There's a structure within the canid world, within the dog world, that is similar from species to species, no matter where you are around the world. It means that there's an adult male, an alpha male, the dominant male, and a dominant female. In coyotes, there are some older children, sometimes an aunt that joins the group as well, that helps raise the particular pups that year. After about 9 to 12 months, many of the younger coyotes disperse into other areas. Those that have survived to that point, the males in particular will disperse. They're not tolerated around very much in the family group. However, females may hang around for quite some time, for, you know, 2, maybe 3 years. Before dispersing or forming their own family group elsewhere in nearby territory, or maybe not so nearby territory, but it's a family grouping based on that sort of relationship with a coyote. In wolves, you have a similar sort of family structure, but there are modifications to it as well.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Jim Pease, wildlife biologist. He's also Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And we're talking about wolves, coyotes, and fox this hour. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me today, and we're talking about some of the prairie's most charismatic predators. We've talked about wolves and how they used to be here and then were exterminated in Iowa. That left a large opening for coyotes, and we have many, many coyotes in the state of Iowa. And so, Jim, earlier we were talking about their family structure. As I said, they're everywhere. Well, where do they live? Other than everywhere, what kind of a habitat are they looking for?
Coyotes or wolves?
Coyotes.
Coyotes. Okay. Coyotes are what I would say are ubiquitous. They are living in cities. There's thought to be, from recent research in the last decade and a half in Chicago area, there are over, believe it or not, 2,000 coyotes in the city of Chicago. So they're living in cities, they're living in small towns, they're living out on the countryside. They're occupying a wide variety of habitats. While we think of them as primarily sort of prairie species that adapt to the woodlands, I can tell you many bow hunters who hunt in woodlands for turkey or deer see coyotes in the woods as well as on the edges of the woods and in the fields. So it's a really wide-ranging. They're a very, very adaptable species, as are many canids. Dogs have become domesticated from their wild cousins a long time ago, and we know how adaptable dogs have been. It's because of that genetic heritage with wild canids that they're able to adapt to a variety of habitats. In fact, we've seen that not only in coyotes but in wolves, because wolves, as they've been reintroduced, have also adapted in many ways to back to, you know, whether they're the original wolves that were here or not genetically. They've done very well for themselves and have readapted to the changes that we have, humans have brought to this modern landscape. And coyotes are the same way. They've adapted extremely well.
So when we say they're everywhere, people who see them often, now you mentioned hunters, people who spend a lot of time outdoors, people who are looking for them,
yeah,
see them.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah,
a lot of people I know are so shocked when they see one.
Yeah.
They ask, what was that? So why don't we see them?
Well, they're primarily, they've adapted, again, to being, while they're diurnal animals, they're out in the daytime and still can be out in the daytime in more rural areas. They've adapted to, they don't like to be around humans except for the things that humans provide. Left out dog and cat food or pet food in general, garbage laying around, nice decks where they can hide under, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we provided some food, water, or shelter in convenient locations for them, and they've adapted to that. But for the most part, they've become much more nocturnal, either very early morning. They're crepuscular as well, so they're early morning or late in the evening at last light, they'll begin to be out hunting. In fact, one of the coyotes I saw this weekend was getting up, stretching itself right at coming on darkness, and was resting below a hay bale by an airport. You know, it was amazing. That's when it was beginning to hunt, and that's what happens. So it's one of the reasons we don't often see them. They become much more nocturnal, although they're very capable of hunting in the daytime and traditionally have. But they certainly have adapted to when humans mostly are not around, and that's at night.
And they're just exceptional at blending in and disappearing.
Disappearing, yeah. There was a recent public TV special on red wolves and coy dog and coy wolf crosses, and there was lots of footage from the studies in Chicago area, and watching them cross streets and hiding behind a building or a car or a tree, you know, at a certain moment when humans were passing by, runners and other things passing by. So have you seen some on your runs?
I have. There's actually a whole family group that lives near where I live, and that's been very interesting to watch their behavior, because who I believe is probably the father, the male.
Sure.
When I run with one of my dogs, who's on an electronic training collar, mm-hmm. so she's not on a leash with me, but she stays very close.
Sure.
He has come out to try to lure her uh-huh. away from where the den is. And so, of course, I keep her close to me. But it's been interesting. You know, he'll stand out in a field, and it almost looks as if he's eliciting play, but definitely trying to get her to chase him.
Right, right. And it may or may not be play. It may be,
right.
Come hither, and I'll have you for lunch. So, and, in fact, that's the other thing that's happened. As coyotes have moved into cities, they've adapted very well. So people who leave their pet food outside, it gets eaten by coyotes as well as other wild critters, but coyotes as well. They have learned to prey particularly on cats that people either let out or leave out all the time. Small dogs, there certainly are lots of instances for many, many years now of coy dog crosses, coyote dog crosses. And how do we know this? We know this because of when they come into season, into heat. And the females of coyotes, of real true coyotes, only come into season once per year, and that's usually around late January to late March, somewhere around in there, for about a two-month period in that area. So they have one group of pups during the spring season. A coy dog, while it may look like a coyote, comes into season twice a year, just like dogs do. And so they can have pups at any time during the year, frequently in the middle of the winter. So you know that it's a coy dog cross if you're finding pups in the middle of the winter. So it's, and there's a lot of that that goes on, particularly with larger dogs as well. But human pets have become part of the urban coyote's diet.
Well, and the certainly not the issue with my dog, because she's larger than a coyote.
Large, right.
But the you know, there's something that, of course, people are very afraid of
sure.
happening. People
yeah.
are very angry when it happens, because we have a hard time adjusting to nature taking its course.
Right.
Things like
right.
that happening, and nobody wants to lose an animal
right.
that they love. But let's talk about what else they eat. What do coyotes look for? What is their natural diet? What did they eat before there were small dogs?
Right,
cats?
Right. So wolves eat large things like elk and bison and deer. Will they take smaller things? Sure, they're opportunistic. They will. Coyotes, on the other hand, being a smaller canid, about half the size, if you will, of a full-grown wolf, weight-wise, they will eat smaller prey. They'll eat lots of rabbits, lots of rodents, mice, squirrels, that sort of thing. But they also eat, depending on the season of the year, but on average for the whole year, probably 90%+ of their diet is meat of some kind. It might be fresh killed, or it might be carrion. On the other hand, coyotes also make use of fruit crops that are available. They will eat worms. They eat insects, grubs, that sort of thing. So they're very opportunistic, depending on what's available and what season. But they're certainly looking for meat, and it's smaller mammals, rabbits, on down, lots of rodents. The third member of the group that we're talking about today, the foxes, which we'll get more into later, we're talking really small prey. Yeah, they'll take some rabbits. Certainly they can surprise them in particular. Some birds, but they're really concentrating on rodents, on small rodents, mice and voles and that sort of thing.
All right, so the kinds of things, very, very different from the
sure.
kinds of things we think about with wolves.
Oh, absolutely.
And definitely yeah. roadkill. You mentioned carrion, so
right.
anything that's already dead out there,
right.
they will partake of. Very
absolutely.
Opportunistic.
Very opportunistic, right, exactly.
All right, so since they have done so well in Iowa, and I mentioned that people fear them, people are afraid of any canines
right.
in the wild, and this fear has been long-lasting because of our relationship with wolves
yeah.
in the past. But what dangers are there, other than we've talked about cats and small dogs possibly getting eaten by coyotes?
Mm.
What do people fear that may have a basis in reality?
Well, certainly the more acclimated they get in urban areas, the greater the chance that they will do something that is not in their character. They've taken advantage. If a person is so careless as to be feeding coyotes, for example, actively, intentionally, by leaving food out for them and watching them, that sort of thing, if you're in the process of doing that, you are habituating them not only to human smells, but to humans in general. So they will come to associate humans with food. And the chance in the long run, then, if you do that sort of thing, is that you're habituating to the point where they will become a danger to children. And there have been instances, particularly in California and some of the cities in the West where they've been around a lot longer, where children have been bitten, that sort of thing. But in every instance, it was by habituated coyotes that had lost their fear of humans. And coyotes generally are they will avoid humans. Even the coyotes that live in cities are very adept at avoiding humans, but still taking advantage of the things that humans do, leaving a plastic bag full of garbage out, compost heaps, on and on and on. They'll take advantage of that sort of thing. But they'll avoid contact with humans. In fact, the ones that I've run into in the field in various circumstances immediately run the other direction. So they're naturally afraid of humans. They've been hunted and trapped for many centuries now by humans. So they have a natural fear of humans. If we overcome that through feeding and other kinds of misbehavior in urban areas, I think we're asking for trouble, not only for ourselves, but for the coyotes themselves.
So don't do that.
Exactly.
All right.
Do
now,
not attempt to feed coyotes, either so that you can get better photos of them or to hand feed them, that sort of thing. That's just not a good idea.
So also, there's been a war on coyotes for ever,
right,
based or, you know, perpetrated by ranchers and other rural people who have been afraid that they will hurt their livestock.
Right.
And is that a fear that actually comes to fruition?
Okay. In terms of coyotes, about the largest wild critter they can take is a fawn, a deer fawn. That would be a large critter. They cannot take down an adult deer, a healthy adult deer with any luck at all. They're just too small for that. But they will take fawns occasionally. So you think about something the size of a fawn. Certainly coyotes are very adept. Again, these are opportunistic predators. And when coyotes are around, just as you get sometimes dogs, going back to their wild heritage, if coyotes are around a sheep flock or a goat flock, they can certainly be a threat to a goat herd, rather. That they can certainly be a threat to both sheep and goats, and smaller livestock as well. And that's well proven over the years that they have been very good predators on strong predators on sheep. Now they kill in a certain way. It's easy to tell a dog kill from a coyote kill, and there have been efforts then to eliminate them in areas where there are substantial numbers of sheep, including in Iowa, or to protect your sheep in other ways. And there are publications that I've been a part of and other people have been a part of in order to avoid those sorts of predation events. But again, they're just taking advantage of what's available for them and killing lambs or even adult sheep in a situation where the sheep aren't very fast and they're a lot easier to kill than a whole bunch of rabbits, chasing down a whole bunch of rabbits. They're just taking advantage of what's available to them.
So some of the predation, though, you said it's easy to tell the difference between a coyote kill and a dog kill, although a lot of predation has been blamed on coyotes that is actually happening because of dogs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So don't leave out dead animals. Don't leave carrion out. Don't try to draw them to you.
Right, right. And when sheep are lambing, what they've done in modern practices in sheep, it's really changed over the years, and sheep and wool growers have become much better about protecting their own flocks. When they're lambing, for example, you bring them into lambing areas that are fenced and protected, rather than allowing them to lamb out in the field, which is just a coyote bait, basically. You know, that's just silly. And we finally learned that, I think, and most modern sheep and wool growers know that and are much better about protecting their flocks. And at the same time, has been for many, many years a market for coyote pelts. And there is an active interest among some Iowans to hunt coyotes because coyotes can be hunted year-round, and there are no limits on the numbers you can take. The vast majority of hunting is done in the, I would say the month of February is probably the most active time for most coyote hunting in the state of Iowa, because it's when there's usually, who knows this year, usually snow on the ground. They're easier to see from a distance, and there are not a lot, not as much cover for them. And other hunting seasons are over, so they often get hunted during the month of February.
But I think, you know, so many people are surprised by how many there are around. That means they're pretty successful at living with humans without causing trouble.
Very, very successful. Yes, they
All
certainly
right.
are.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about fox when we get back. Red fox and gray fox. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, your comments, your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here, and we're talking about wolves, coyotes, and we're going to turn the conversation to fox here in just a moment, although we do have a couple of coyote questions for you, Jim, before we move on to talking about fox.
Sure.
You can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Here's a question. Ed is on the line in Algona. Hi, Ed.
Hello. How are we doing?
Good.
What's your question?
Good. My question today is I had heard that coyotes will respond to hunting pressure by having larger litters. So the smaller the population, the larger the litter is what I've heard. I didn't know if that was a wives' tale or if there's some scientific data to back that up.
No, there's a lot of scientific evidence to that. That's exactly what happens. Now the reason it happens is what's up the most interesting, I think. And if you look at a lot of wild animal populations, litter size and fecundity, the ability to have young, is a function of largely a function of nutrition. And so if you extrapolate that, you say, well, you've eliminated half the coyote population in an area, or three quarters of the coyote population. The remaining coyotes tend to have larger litters. Why is that? Because they're better fed. I think that is the explanation. I don't think it's a, you know, the implication a lot of times I've seen in various stories in the popular press is that it's a conscious response. Oh, we're going to have larger litters because, you know, Fred and Charlie and all the rest of them got blown away. So we're going to make more pups. No, I think it's a more of a nutritional response to the availability of prey then. And because coyotes only have one litter a year, it takes them a while to respond, but they do, in fact, tend to have larger litters in areas where the populations have been severely limited.
Which you see in most species, right?
Absolutely. You see it in rabbits, you see it in mice, all sorts of species. And again, I think it's a nutritional response more than a conscious response to let's breed more because we have more room for our kind.
But it also just makes sense as far as survival of a species.
Absolutely.
Cecilia's on the line next in Davenport. Hi, Cecilia.
Hello, Charity. I just can't hear anyone talking of coyotes without thinking of Barbara Kingsolver's book, Prodigal Summer, her novel written in 2000, that I don't know if you or Jim are familiar with that one.
I have not read it. My wife has it. I bought it for her for Christmas, so I will soon read it, absolutely. So.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for the recommendation, Cecilia. A lot of great books about coyotes.
Yes, there
out
are.
There.
There
God's
really
Dog
are.
By Hope Ryden is one of my favorites. Right. And I do want to move on to talking about fox before we run out of time, and we've been talking about canines this hour. A lot of people lump fox into that category.
Right.
Are fox canines?
Well, That's a question, I guess. A lot of people, there are certain taxonomists who would put them sort of in their own category, but because of the structure of traditionally, taxonomically, if you look at the structure of their skull and other bones in their bodies, morphologically, they seem certainly to be canids. They have the certain teeth structure, the skull structure, the body structure. There are folks who are saying, gee, they really belong in their own category, their own family. I don't know if that has been resolved, but certainly foxes appear and act very, very much like canines. So I would put them there, yes.
All right. And we've got two different kinds of foxes in the state?
Yeah, we have red fox, but we also have, the red fox tends to be more a creature of the grassland, of the prairie that was once here. And certainly they'll use the edge of the woods. But the gray fox is certainly very much a woodland critter and, in fact, can climb trees. If you've ever come across gray fox in the wild and seen them up a tree, you might say, what the heck is that, that fox doing up that tree? The one time I've seen a gray fox, I should say the first time I saw a gray fox in the wild, he was actually coming down a tree, and I was absolutely flabbergasted. So out along the Des Moines River Valley, and it was great to see that, because they're very cat-like as they come down the tree. So, but it's a fascinating critter because it is one of the most widespread animals in the world, mammals in the world. It is the same species, although there are a number of subspecies across all of Eurasia, the boreal forests of Europe and Asia, of North Africa. It's in across Canada and the U.S. It's an extremely widespread species with many subspecies. And we have other foxes in other parts of the U.S. We have the Swift fox in the Great Plains, and we have the Kit fox along the West Coast. But really, the red fox is the most widespread. It's called all kinds of things, from colored fox to cross fox. There are all sorts of local names for them as well. But, it's a really there are two species in Iowa, the gray and the red.
The fact that fox are so widespread probably is a pretty big hint, but it sounds to me like they're pretty adaptable to their environment.
Very adaptable, and their diet shows it. They certainly eat small mammals, things like rabbits if they can catch them, but they really concentrate on a small rodent population, and they are key for controlling mouse populations in an area. So they're really a very important predator on small rodents. Ground squirrels, absolutely, certainly, mice, voles, but they'll also eat lots of insects. They eat lots of berries when they're in season, as do lots of things, including coyotes. They'll eat worms. They'll dig in logs for grubs. Sometimes in grassy areas, they'll dig down for grubs that might be found there. They'll certainly eat ground nesting birds, particularly the eggs of birds and nestlings if they're in there. So they're a very wide diet, very, very adaptable. So that in a certain area, and they will eat carrion as well. So if another animal has killed something and left it behind, foxes will scavenge on it. I witnessed this, Cindy and I witnessed this when we were in Africa this last year. We watched a fox stand on the edge of a lion kill, waiting his turn very patiently. But when hyenas had a kill, they would tend to kind of jump in and see if they could grab a piece before the hyena would chase them away. So they're very bold little buggers sometimes.
A lot of people see them in town and are surprised to see them in town. Do we see them commonly in urban areas?
Very commonly, particularly since most of our towns were not built out in the middle of absolute wide-open prairie. They're, most of our towns and cities are built along rivers and streams, that sort of thing, for a number of reasons we won't go into here. But certainly, because there's habitat there, and we also have lots, we tend to want to have parks, and so they take advantage of that. They have corridors with those rivers and streams that run through our towns and cities where they can move along without being detected. There are lots of rabbits in town. We have, I've known where all the dens were in the campus area of Iowa State University, and we had three distinct den sites for foxes in the general Iowa State University campus, and three different vixens that were or that had pups there, and they would regularly hunt in central campus at nighttime and in the very early morning hours. I once had the president call me, saying that as he was walking to work from the presidential house to over to Beardshire,
which is on campus in kind of a little wooded area,
right? Exactly. He watched a fox walking right across central campus with a great big rabbit in his mouth, and wondered how he could get that fox to come to his yard and take care of some of the rabbits there as well. So it was they're very, very common in park and urban rural areas. As I say, most of our towns and cities are built along in habitat, and we have created habitat for them in the forms of cemeteries, golf courses, parks, even many of our yards are perfect fox habitat, and they just simply take advantage of that.
So although we may be surprised to see them, it sounds like we should be surprised we don't see them more often.
Exactly. Yeah, but they're like coyotes. They're so skilled at at adapting to humans. And again, I think it goes back to that sort of ancient genetic makeup. The reason dogs were domesticated so easily is because they figured out how to manipulate us as much as we figured out how to manipulate them. And I think that's in their genes. And so they've done very, very well around humans up to the present day.
How do they get along with humans and with our pets?
Well, they certainly will. Usually they get along very well because they're smaller. They're about the size of a very large house cat. You're talking about, there's certainly variation around their wide range around the world, but we're talking about animals that are basically at adult size, about 10 pounds to maybe 20 pounds.
And they look larger than they are because
they
that tail tends to be about the same size as the body.
Right, right.
Which it gives an illusion of size.
Yeah.
It's not really accurate.
Well, it's a full third of the total length of the body, the tail of a fox in particular. And then it's this large, puffy tail that they use very effectively in the wintertime as a muff to fold over their nose and eyes so that they can sleep, they don't lose heat out that, and can sleep warmly at night with that very bushy tail.
Wish I had one of those.
Yeah.
We have a question on the line from Ralph in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Say, I don't see too many gray fox in the Poweshiek, Iowa County area. Is that
right?
Standard for certain places have less or more?
Well, certainly there's variation not only in the state, in the habitat areas of the state. You would expect more gray fox in the eastern third of Iowa, where there are more woodlands than there are in the western two-thirds. But you'll see them along larger wooded river valleys, like the Des Moines River. It is wooded well up for much of its full length. And so you will see them in that river valley. But it certainly varies not only from the area of the state where you are, but what's available locally in terms of habitat, the pressure they might get from hunting or trapping. And certainly from year to year, there are diseases as well that impact not only food availability, but the diseases directly to the coyotes and foxes. Mange is often a big controller of a big contributor to reduced fox and coyote populations. And we see that sort of run rampant through a fox population in a certain area. Foxes will be seemingly absent from that area for a number of years and then suddenly sort of reappear as other foxes reinvade the area. So, yeah, you don't see them very often, even in areas where there are a lot of them. But if you spend a lot of time in the woods, sitting quietly in camouflage, like a lot of bow hunters and turkey hunters do, then you have a greater likelihood of seeing them than otherwise, than just hiking or jogging along a trail.
But there are more red foxes than gray foxes.
Oh, by far, yes, right. By far. Yeah,
and
gray
foxes
much more common.
Are harder to see.
Yes, much harder. Well, they're up in trees. We don't look up very often. You know? They're not always up in trees, but they can climb very easily.
Well, and of course, you know, wooded areas just make it a little harder to spot anybody.
Absolutely.
If you want to see a fox, how would you go about it?
Well, I would go out and listen at night. They have a high-pitched yip and a yelp, which is different than the coyotes.
Well, let's listen to a red fox bark here. All right, so that gives you a little bit of an idea.
Sounds more chihuahua-like, doesn't it?
A little bit.
So, yeah, they sound smaller, and if you go out and listen, you know they're in the area. And again, I would just sit quietly and watch. And please do not attempt to feed them, to leave out cat food or anything for them.
They're adorable.
I understand
the temptation, but that's not safe for anybody.
Exactly, especially for the fox. And it's much more likely to become a problem than if you just watch them carefully from a distance. But I would go to some areas where you might try cemeteries and that sort of thing. Listen for that high-pitched, almost chihuahua-like bark, and you will know they're in the area, and then you can go out you can use red cellophane, cover a bright flashlight to cover that, and you can maybe able to spot their eyes from a distance.
And the gray fox have a kind of a scream. They have a bark that's similar to the red fox, but then they also have a kind of scream. But that scream is so similar to like a juvenile great horned owl.
Exactly.
It's hard to pick it out.
Or even to bobcats. It sounds to me sometimes like a bobcat, a sort of squeal. It sounds like a dying rabbit, a screaming rabbit. You know, there are lots of things that it sounds like. So, yeah, I agree. It's much harder to figure it out.
So what do you think we can take away from the fact that we are surrounded by coyotes and foxes, although not that many of us do get a chance to see them?
Well, it says to me that they're a very adaptable critter that is a lot like us. Canids in general have some of the adaptability characteristics of human beings. And as a result, the changes we brought to the landscape, unless we come into conflict with them, they've done very, very well with the changes. Certainly wolves, we've had several instances of wolves in Iowa in the last several years, but I don't think that we'll be able to adapt to them very well in this agricultural landscape.
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, he's Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.